Matthews got it, wants to throw, looks right, throws out there, wants Marvin Jones, end zone. Did he catch it? You bet. Touchdown, Detroit Lions. Oh, Marvin locked up with Devon House down the right sideline. Stafford dropped it in the basket. Marvin hauled it in, 25 yards, and a touchdown.
Who needs the red zone, right?
They got nine men in there. Stafford turns, toss, sweep, Abdullah trying to get the edge. Hit the five, cuts it up to the end zone. Touchdown, Detroit Lions. Matthew wants to throw again.
Here they come.
Set up the screen, got it to Riddick. He's got room to run. Riddick, 35, 40. Riddick at midfield. Riddick into Packer territory, 40. Cuts right at the 30. Riddick at the 20. And Riddick finally taken down inside the 15-yard line. They set up the screen, and it blew up. They are deep in Packer territory after a 63-yard run after the catch by Theo Riddick. Lions on second and nine from the Packer 11. Stafford out of the gun. He's got it. Wants to throw. Looking right. Throws. End zone. It is... Did he get it? He did! Touchdown, Detroit Lions! Marvin Jones, oh, what a catch! Two teams will meet out in the middle of the field to say, job well done, job better done on this night by the Detroit Lions, and man, did they need it.
This was an important game for us. It was very important because it's the next game, and it was a division game. It was good to get one at this time. Certainly, he played well. The guys caught the ball well for him all across the board. Marvin with over 100 yards, Golden with over 100. Ebron had some nice catches. Obviously, Theo does what Theo does. When he catches it, makes some things happen. So when he does have time, he can deliver it.
You know, every game is huge, you know, especially a division game on the road in a tough place to play like Lambeau. It was a game we were, excited about, a Monday nighter. You know, I'm just glad we came out and performed. It was a total team win. Our defense played great. Our special teams was great as well. You know, we keep putting performances like that, you know, together, we'll give ourselves a good chance to win. You know, we just got to continue to get better. We weren't perfect. We left some points out there, got down in the red zone, stalled out a couple times again. It was an efficient night.
For any of that shenanigan stuff. We're not going to have that. I think Josh knows that. I think if Josh is back here, he's going to conform and do the things that we need him to do to be a contributing member of this football team. Right now, he's on our team. He's a guy that has an opportunity to move forward in his life. Do we want to have all the other things that come with it? I think hopefully that's behind him. We don't. Let's just be honest. We don't want those things. But as we move forward, if he can do the things that we do as football team members and conduct himself the right way and handle those things, Josh Gordon is welcome back here.
This is just a matter of getting to a deal too late in the process. Both Cincinnati and us tried our damnedest to try to get the paperwork in at the last minute. And we're talking about minutes and seconds before the trade deadline ended. We were on the phone with the NFL at the time to try to make it happen. It did not happen. I do think Cincinnati and Ernest tried it. I know we did everything humanly possible to get it done. It just didn't happen. It is truly that simple. There's no paperwork that either side got in that would allow a deal to happen, and it's truly that simple. They had our paperwork, we had theirs, and then it was incumbent upon us to send it.
They're going to have to make some starting lineup changes, I believe. And that's a little bit of an issue within the team right now. We had Dwayne Wade come in, get a starting job when not everybody on the team thought he should have got one. Then he took a step back out of that starting job. And now, yesterday, and he's criticizing the starters after the game, saying, I'm kind of tired as a second unit having to come in here and always, you know, come back from a 15-point lead. Which, by the way, he's right. The Cavs are the worst team in the NBA in the first quarter. And that's the starters.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. It is the extravaganza. Hope you're having an outstanding start, or not start, I should say, an outstanding day today. It's more toward the end of it, actually, here at 11 minutes after 3. But thanks for being a part of it, no matter what time that it is. Or maybe you're listening by podcast, so you're starting your day or ending your day with it that way. We've got a great show lined up for you today. Coming up, we're going to talk with Maniloff about two messes out in Cleveland, just a little bit to the east of northwest Ohio. The Cavaliers are a wreck. They are a wreck. They will not reach wretched status for a while, but right now they're a wreck. The Browns, however, have reached wretched status. You just heard a little bit there from Sashi Brown and Hugh Jackson. There was a big press conference yesterday, Sashi Brown trying to tell the media and the fans why he doesn't suck at his job, trying to tell them why they should be allowed to continue at their jobs. He failed. Nothing was believable. Not one single iota of logic to what Sashi Brown said about their ridiculous failure to get that trade pulled off. It is a comedy. It is a comedy of errors. It's a comedy. And you know what, Jim Crishlin, I find myself really, really, as you know, you and I are both Cleveland natives, and we both are Cleveland sports fans. But you know what, Jim? I feel really bad about this because of DeShone Kizer. I want to wish good things to DeShone Kizer.
Mm-hmm.
But if my wish for the Browns comes true, he will be taken down in the process. My wish is for the Browns to go 0-16. My wish is for the Browns to absolutely blow up this train wreck of a front office slash coaching staff slash ownership group, quite frankly, that they have. I want the entire thing virtually just a wrecking ball taken to the entire place and start over again, if not start over in another city. I don't give a crap if they're even around anymore. But the sad part about that is if they go 0-16 and DeShone starts the rest of the season, well, then he is a rookie quarterback as 0-16. And I know he didn't start one game, but you understand the point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to see bad things happen to this guy. He got wrecked because he was drafted by the worst franchise in all
yep.
of team sports. And I feel terrible because I want them to fail so that it is a true and total remake from the beginning or total reboot. But yet I want him to succeed. So it's a really difficult place to be.
No, and that's an interesting take on it. And I can kind of see the sad but yet perverted but unfortunate logic that comes from something like that. There, sometimes you need it to fully bottom out. And clearly, last year's 1-15 bottoming out.
Well, you know what it is, Jim? It's the Browns are a metaphor for Josh Gordon. Or Josh Gordon is a metaphor for the Browns. Josh Gordon needed to hit that proverbial rock bottom, as all addicts talk about. You know, before you ever truly start to recover and become a recovering addict, a recovering alcoholic, a recovering drug user, mm-hmm. recovering this or that or the other. I mean, really, you need to hit rock bottom to the point where there is nothing left for you. It's the only way for so many people in that circumstance to get right. And we'll talk about Gordon, too, because of his amazing confession to GQ Magazine that we talked about at the end of the show yesterday. We'll spend some more time on today. His amazing confession that he would drink alcohol or smoke marijuana or use drugs or both or some combination of all prior to each and every game that he has played in his NFL career and going back all the way to his days at Baylor. And to me, that sounds like he finally truly is recovering and not just, you know, for show like he tried to a few other times while he tried to mask his infractions, if you will. He tried to cover those things up. Now he's laying them all out bare for the world to see. That truly shows me that he did, you know, for being a layman, I'm not a doctor,
mm-hmm.
but you know, it's to me, it looks like he did hit rock bottom, and that's what's enabling him to now possibly rise up. That's what the Browns have to do, and I think 0-16 would do it. So that's just kind of the that's why so many players, just, you know, they talk about, well, I might stay in school depending on how the draft looks. In other words, if there's a chance I could get drafted, Sam Darnold said this.
Yep.
The USC quarterback said a few days ago that he's not sure if he's going to come out. It's just going to depend on what the draft looks like. And that's code for if the Browns are not picking number one, screw you. I will play for USC another year. I'll take out an insurance policy on my arm and my shoulder and my ribs and my everything. And make
anything
sure
to
that
avoid
my,
coming to Cleveland.
To avoid coming there. That is exactly correct.
You know, and with that, and you mentioned, you know, Kizer, and part of what's could wreck his possible career as being the quarterback for the Browns. He probably never has crossed his mind yet, but I wonder if you're DeShone Watson. I could have been drafted by the Browns, or I do what happened in real life and I tear my ACL halfway through the season. There's no win in that.
No, I disagree. I think he would rather have had what happened happen. You know,
and if that were to ever be the case, there's no way to find that out unless somebody point
blank
asks.
What I mean is,
that is another thing that shows where the Browns really are in the minds of people.
Well, it's true. That's true.
I'd rather tear my ACL than play for you.
But it would have to be all things happening. In other words, I got a chance to play my first 7 games.
Right. Okay. Yes.
And
yes.
I threw 17 touchdowns and it set a record for you know, most touchdowns in your first 7 games of a career. And you know, it was on my way to Rookie of the Year. Maybe MVP consideration if he had a second half like his first half, and then tore the ACL. But I know that where I am and what I have in front of me is the world
mm-hmm.
once this rehab happens. Or have my entire career ruined from day one the way Deshaun Kizer's is, because I'm with the worst franchise, with the worst coaches, with the worst player personnel people, the worst receiving core, the worst everything that there is in the business, knowing that I have no chance of succeeding until I escape my rookie contract. I feel like Deshaun Kizer would take that ACL every day of the week and twice on Sunday if it meant avoiding the fate of Deshaun Kizer.
Yeah, so. And you're probably right. I doubt anyone's going to ask him point blank, but for some reason that just popped in my head. Yeah. Because as we know, back on draft day, they thought, a lot of us, myself included, thought that they were going to pick him, and then of course they did what Brown seemed to always do on draft day. Can we talk about a good football team for once?
I was just about to say, enough of the losing quarterbacks and enough of the losers out there. We'll talk to Maniloff about that situation. Let's talk about what we called last night. For a while, we talked about must win, but we said it was a must win that they beat New Orleans. Then we said it was a must win that they beat the Steelers, and they didn't do either one. So yesterday, we called it a cannot lose, which is a little different than a must win, I guess, in name only, against the Green Bay Packers at Lambeau, where we know it has not been favorable for them for the last 25 years. How about Matthew Stafford's prime time performance, showing the world, in my opinion, showing the world this is why they gave me the richest contract in the history of the National Football League. And it will remain so until, of course, the next superstar quarterback signs the deal that breaks his. But it was his turn. And quite frankly, Jim, he had not been having that kind of a season.
No.
He had not had a season to date that warranted his place among the upper echelon of quarterbacks. There was still the separation between the Rodgers, Brady, Roethlisberger. And I think this year, Wentz has ascended into that conversation. Breeze, Russell Wilson, and, you know, those individuals. Mm-hmm. And then there was the next tier. And I'm sorry, but Matthew Stafford, the way he had played at the beginning of the season for the first half of the season, was in that next tier, probably the top of the next tier, but it was certainly in the next tier. Last night, I feel, and I don't want to say he was waiting. Clearly he's not. He's trying to play his best every game. But from just a fan standpoint, it's almost like he was waiting to show the world on prime time, Monday Night Football. No other games going on, just me at Lambeau. 26 out of 33, that kind of passing accuracy and efficiency, with two touchdowns, no picks, a QBR of 93.4, a rating of 132.4. An absolutely outstanding day.
Mm-hmm.
For Matthew Stafford, and a showcase, I think, not only for himself, but for what his team can be in a hyper-competitive NFC. We spent a lot, and by the way, congratulations to Marvin Jones Jr. as well.
Yes.
For continuing his ascendancy, you know, up the charts, if you will, not just, you know, we'll start just there with the Lions' go-to guy. You know, Golden Tate still has more receptions, but Marvin Jones Jr. is fine in the end zone. He's making some big plays. He's got five touchdown catches now on the year, which is three more than Golden. They each caught seven balls for over 100 yards yesterday. Spreading the love around was Mr. Stafford. But congratulations to him. I feel like this was a showcase for Matthew Stafford's skills, but also, as I say, we talked yesterday with Jeremy Reisman of PrideToDetroit.com with a preview of the game, and we just kind of talked about the hyper-competitive nature of the NFC. And it really, truly is. The best teams, I think, the best competitive teams reside in the NFC. I feel like, and we talked about this, I didn't really get your take on it, Jim, that the AFC is a two-team conference at this point, at the halfway point, at the eight-game mark, with the Patriots and the Steelers being kind of heads and shoulders above everybody else. But out in the NFC, the Eagles are legit. The Cowboys, if Zeke Elliott stays on the field, are legit. The Vikings and that defense, even with Case Keenum, are legitimate. The Saints, we had a little difference of agreement. I like the Rams more than the Saints, but Jeremy liked the Saints more than the Rams. Let's suffice it to say, both are serious threats, as are the second-place teams in the South and West divisions, respectively, the Panthers at 6-3 and the Seahawks at 5-3.
the Lions are going to get left in the dust by that huge group of really, you know, can I say Super Bowl contenders at the break? Maybe, maybe not, but deep playoff run participants. And the Lions would not be included in that if they didn't have not only a win last night, and I kind of said this to Jeremy, but a statement win. Not just a we eked one out in Green Bay, and he said, no, they'll take a win however they get it. And, well, of course that's true. But a statement win showing the NFC, don't sleep on us. It's only 4-4 now, but we are going to be in the thick of this thing. And I think that's exactly what they did last night.
Yeah, absolutely. I think last night was their most complete game on either side of the ball. And especially that offensively, it's not just Stafford, although what he was able to do in you know, being under center and everything. You know what I really like about this one? Did you know the Lions? How many times do you think the Lions punted yesterday?
I have no idea, but it's not
zero.
Many. No, they didn't even have one?
Not one.
Wow.
The only two drives the Lions did not score on was their one turnover, a fumble in the third quarter, and a field goal miss early stages of the second quarter. Otherwise, they scored on every other single drive. That's you, if you're an offensive coordinator, if you're Jim Bob Cooter, you cannot ask for a more efficient offensive sequence, not just from your quarterback, but everybody on that offensive side of the ball.
24 first downs, third down efficiency, 8 out of 13.
There it is.
8 out of 13. So in those other five, what are we looking at? End of half, field goal.
Yeah, they had three total field goals and a field goal miss. That's four of them right there.
That's four of the five, and then one other, maybe a... I don't know. Was that a kneel down, maybe?
I can't remember.
No, it doesn't matter. But the point is, they didn't punt, as you pointed out. And it was really, truly a complete win. The exact kind of statement win. Now, how loud was the statement, considering Aaron Rodgers wasn't in the other huddle? Not as loud or as boisterous as perhaps it could be. But Brett Hundley wasn't terrible. Brett Hundley.
No.
Not Aaron Rodgers, but, you know, 26 of 38 isn't awful. He didn't get it into the end zone, you know, no passing touchdowns.
But he didn't throw any picks either.
But his quarterback rating was 86, which means it was a solid NFL game. So take nothing away from the Lions. They did exactly what they needed to do in what we were calling yesterday a must-not-lose game. All right, Jim, it's 3:24. Let's get wild.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents The Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
Wild Stat of the Day does indeed involve these Lions. We think back to 1991 and the gap for the Lions winning anything at Lambeau Field. Not only did Detroit win at Lambeau yesterday, second time since 91, they did so with their biggest margin since a 30-10 win there way back in 1982. Also of note, that was the only Lions-Packers meeting of that 82 season, which was just a 9-game season due to the player strike of that year. So that is your Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day. All right, we're going to stay in the NFL and talk about that very bizarre press conference held yesterday by the laughingstock known as the Cleveland Clowns franchise. Cavaliers are in a bad way. Pistons are in a good way. We're going to hit those things as well. Maniloff will join us after the bottom of the hour. Sports Center, which is coming up directly right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Once again, it's the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
I do think Cincinnati and Ernest tried it. I know we did everything humanly possible to get it done. It just didn't happen. It is truly that simple. There's no paperwork that either side got in that would allow a deal to happen, and it's truly that simple. They had our paperwork, we had theirs, and then it was incumbent upon us to send it.
Yeah, it was just truly that simple, says Sashi Brown with all of his NFL player personnel and front office experience. It was just really that simple. What an absolute embarrassment. The single biggest, most embarrassing organization in all of team sports. And I'm not talking about the Cleveland Cavaliers, believe it or not. I'm talking about the Cleveland Browns. Yes, both of them are a bit of a wreck right now. Joining us now from Cleveland to talk about those teams and their problems is our good friend Dennis Maniloff, who covers them for the Cleveland Plain Dealer and Cleveland.com. D-Man, how are you, sir?
What's up, Bob France? How you doing?
I'm good, man. I'm real good. I feel good. There's a lot good going on, but not with the teams that I grew up watching and cheering for. Dennis, I want to start with the wreck that is the Browns, and then we'll talk about just the mess that the Cavs are right now, because one of them is legendary, and one of them is ongoing and has been for more than 20 years, And, yes, I'm going back to pre-moving to Baltimore rec areas as well when I say more than 20 years. One of them is just an absolute embarrassment. The other one is just off to a start that is, it just defies belief. So let's start with Sashi Brown, Dennis. Yesterday, he had a little press conference talking to yourself and your colleagues there in the media, the beat writers and so on and so forth, and he says there was no truth to the rumor that he or anybody else in the front office wanted to sabotage the McCarron trade because they really didn't want him that badly. They had second thoughts, and the best way to back out of it would be to just get the paperwork in late and have the trade denied by the league. He says it's simply not true. Do you believe him, Dennis?
Oh, boy. That's tough for me to say that Sashi Brown's a liar, if you will. I mean, I guess you could always parse out some truth or create some ambiguity in answers. Here's the bottom line, Bob. So my long answer is, I can't imagine that Brown and his crew like A.J. McCarron anywhere near to the extent that Hugh Jackson does. Therefore, I believe there is a possibility that Hugh Jackson tried the end around on the front office because he's so frustrated with his lack of talent that he's been provided. And you can say what you want about, you know, Jackson perhaps wanted Kaiser, okay, so he made his own bed. But the bottom line is Jackson's in I have to win mode, and he doesn't think Kaiser can deliver him the victories right now. So he, when he sees the Garoppolo thing doesn't happen, he goes, oh, you know what? I got to get a quarterback. I think I can get McCarron. And it is possible, I think, that the front office somehow, some way didn't allow it to happen.
Dennis, I'm going to,
I'm not saying it did. I'm not saying that happened, Bob.
No,
but
it's
I'm
possible.
Saying it's possible.
I agree
it's
with
possible.
You. It's possible. I agree it's possible. And I do not believe, well, let me put it to you this way. Whether it was intentional sabotage or unintentional incompetence, either way, it underscores the absolute necessity that the entire organization be blown up. And I mean straight up, call the authorities, get them to plant the explosives, and just blow the whole damn thing up. An implosion so everything falls neatly to the ground. And I mean that literally and figuratively. I would just start the whole damn thing over and build a new facility if they were indeed intending on keeping the team there in Cleveland. But specifically from a figurative standpoint, you've got to blow this guy out. You have to blow the baseball scout out. You have to blow Hugh Jackson and his staff of incompetent coaches out. And quite frankly, the city should tell Jimmy Haslam in order to keep the lease that you've got, you've got to sell the team because you need to be out as well. But let's focus on Sashi Brown. I've been describing him as just the lawyer, the head honchos of the Browns organization, the guys responsible for building a roster and turning around the biggest laughing stock in sports, a lawyer and a baseball scout. Well, I keep thinking to myself, there's got to be more to Sashi Brown than just a lawyer. He had to have done some work in general management type duties. Maybe he was an assistant GM. Maybe he was a player personnel director. Maybe he was a college scout. So I just went to Wiki, and I wanted to look it up. And here's what I've got. Sashi Brown, executive vice president of the Cleveland Browns, having assumed the position January 3rd, 2016, replacing fired GM Ray Farmer. He previously held the position with the organization as the team's executive vice president and general counsel, in which he was hired by the Browns in January 2013. In other words, lawyer. He was a team lawyer. He was not a team personnel director or having anything to do with roster building. Prior to that, Brown was an attorney with the Wilmer Cutler Pickering Hale and Dorr, a private law firm based in Washington, D.C. Firm's corporate law practice group, advised companies in business transactions, earned an undergraduate degree from Hampton University, doctorate degree, Harvard Law, member of the New York District of Columbia and Florida Bars. Oh, he did, however, work with the Jacksonville Jaguars organization. Where? Team scout? No. Served as a member of the board of directors and chairman of the Section 8 subcommittee to the Jacksonville Housing Authority. He also played a role in negotiating the naming rights to Everbank Field. Holy hell. That's the entirety of his professional experience. And as we watch for 2 years, Dennis, they've added 24 players to the roster in draft picks alone. There's only 7 draft rounds a year, and yet somehow they managed to get 24 draft picks, and damned if there's one, maybe Miles Garrett, impact player among them. How does this no experience having, bumbling Three Stooges meets Benny Hill type of executive vice president remain in control of a professional sports franchise after botching or intentionally sabotaging that trade?
Well, here's the thing. If I'm Jimmy Haslam, or Jimmy and D, the Haslams, you know, the first thing I do is I pray that there's no smoking gun that will get me entangled in this whole Pilot Flying J legal mess. Okay, that's number one. Number two, assuming that you're fine on the legal front with Pilot Flying J, if you're Jimmy Haslam and D Haslam, you say, we have a disconnect, severe disconnect between the front office and the coaches. At the very minimum. And that's what, you know, cast aside all the stuff about the McCarron fiasco. And I'm actually glad. And it's one time where I'm glad that the fiasco blew up and that it didn't work out for the Browns, because I don't think McCarron is worth one of those picks, let alone two. So good for the Browns for not getting McCarron. But at the very least, regardless of what you think about how it went down or who sabotaged what or incompetence, the bottom line is it underscores a dramatic disconnect between the front office and the coaches. That cannot be allowed to stand if you want to get where you want to go. So if you're Haslam, you have to make a decision. Do I blow out the front office? Do I blow out the coaching staff? Or do I get rid of both? If you blow out the front office and you bring in a new front office, then that front office presumably is going to want its own coach. And it's not going to want to inherit a coach. That rarely works, where you bring in a front office and a coach is in place and that thing works. So if you go ahead with the front office being jettisoned, then you're going to get rid of the coach presumably as well. I think, though, that it starts with the front office really has got to has served its purpose. Let's put it that way. This front office, this group led by Brown and DePodesta, have done a good job of accruing draft picks, of accruing assets. They've been creative with a few trades here and there. But I get the feeling that you have to have the next level for this is the football guys come in and actually make the football calls on the personnel. And that means that it's time for Brown and DePodesta to step aside. They served their purpose in the build. Now it's time to turn it over to the football guys and let them make the calls.
I respect what you say about that. I don't know that I would be as generous and kind in even saying that they served their purpose in acquiring draft picks, because they acquired draft picks in each of the last two drafts through trade downs, and as we said, managed to pick 24 players in two drafts. And again, they can't find good ones. And I guess that's your point about why, okay, let somebody else make them, when you have 2 ones and 3 twos and all the other incredible draft pick numbers that they have this year. If you don't know what to do with them, what purpose is there in trading down to get them? Because you're passing over the league MVP, Carson Wentz, 1 year. You're passing over the rookie of the year and might have been in competition for league MVP with a second half as dynamic as the first half, and Deshaun Watson another year. You know, you just continue to be afraid to make the pick of the quarterback that you would then have to develop because you're scared that it's the wrong one. So, like, I don't want to take a chance on it. I'll trade down and get some more picks. I don't applaud them for accumulating picks as part of a build. I criticize them for being cowards with no confidence in their own little damned aerodynamics or whatever the hell they call them, analytics. With Podesta's computer and his numbers and Sashi Brown's keen eye after having spent all of these years in a law firm watching football on television, they had no guts, no belief that what they actually were hired to do that they could do. So rather than take the wrong quarterback with the first overall pick or second overall pick or whatever, the safe thing to do is just trade down, and we'll get a whole bunch of picks. And then if we don't get the right guy, we'll get a whole bunch of really good guys, and that'll offset everything. Dennis, they're cowards. I don't think they've built. Yeah. I think they've run and hidden. They've run and hidden from their jobs.
Well, let me just say this. I'm not defending them when I make this point, make the following point. But we will never know exactly how intertwined, or we might know sometime down the road when a book is written. But we don't know right now how intertwined Jackson is to the decision making of Brown defense and the crew, specifically as pertains to the quarterbacks. In other words, did Hugh Jackson like Carson Wentz? And was he talked out of it by the analytics guys? Did the analytics guys like Carson Wentz? And were they talked out of it by Hugh Jackson? Was Hugh Jackson bullish on Deshaun Watson? I think so. Was he denied the opportunity to pick Deshaun Watson at 12 overall in this past draft? We don't know if it was a front office overrule. Perhaps the front office said to Hugh Jackson, look, we gave you the opportunity to bring in Robert Griffin III in 2016, and that didn't work. So we're not going to allow you necessarily to tell us how to go with the first round the following year with a quarterback. We're going to, trade down. So we won't know how much of the thought process on these quarterbacks specifically was directly related to or directly tied to the front office versus Jackson. What I will say, though, is the Browns are unique, as we know, as the worst franchise arguably in professional sports, because not only do they have an owner whose main company is in incredible legal trouble, but they have a front office and a coaching staff where it's very difficult to defend either one. Usually, out of the three, out of ownership, front office, and coaching, you can find one of the three on a professional team that is solid, where you can point to and say, well, at least they have a really good coach, at least they have a really good front office, or at least they have a really good owner. The Browns, you can't do that. Any of the three. The Haslams, there's no way to defend their ownership in Cleveland. The front office is current front office. It's very, very, very difficult to defend what they've been able to, accomplish, in quotes. And Hugh Jackson, as great a hire as he was, proclaimed to be, he's almost impossible to defend.
He is impossible to defend. He has bungled this quarterback situation with Kaiser from day one, with his promises that we'll live through the ups and the downs, the highs and the lows, the touchdowns and the picks, the great plays and the mistakes, because it's all a part of this young man's journey. We're in it for the long haul. And then, oh, you're not winning enough games for me, benched. Oh, you're not winning enough games for me, benched at halftime. You know, what's he doing with this kid and the yo-yo rotation that he's got him on? He has bungled this from the beginning. He won't hire an offensive coordinator. The man is absolutely not a head coach in this league. He's proven it now in two different places. He is a coordinator masquerading as a head coach.
I mean, it started with the Robert Griffin decision. I mean, this to me was 99.9% Hugh Jackson. You can't tell me the front office was like, oh, yeah, we got to get Robert Griffin III and try to resuscitate his career. So that one's on Hugh Jackson, the fact that it blew up. You're telling us that Cody Kessler, trust him on Kessler. They obviously passed on Wentz during Jackson's regime. They didn't wind up drafting Watson during Jackson's regime. They acquire Osweiler, although I can't believe that was something that Jackson wanted. But here's the thing. Didn't keep Osweiler as a veteran mentor, which is something you would think Jackson would insist upon. Hey,
absolutely.
Look at this quarter. Look at this potential quarterback room. It's Kaiser, Kessler, and Hogan, who have a grand total of zero NFL victories. I need a veteran in here who can, you know, at least sit there, even if he's not starting, at least be some sort of a mentor to Kizer. That didn't happen. As you said, the mismanagement of Kizer, the way he's Jackson has gone into panic mode where Kizer's development is concerned. So this so-called quarterback whisperer has just hasn't gotten it done.
No.
Where the most important position, arguably in professional sports, quarterback, is concerned.
No, there's no question about that. Dennis Manilov joining us. So, Dennis, going back to the press conference yesterday and the first thing that I asked you about with Brown, if you had to flip a coin, well, don't flip a coin, make your best pick, was it incompetence or was it intentional sabotage? Because neither one, to me, should allow Sashi Brown to keep his job. If he wanted that trade and botched it because he didn't get the paperwork done right, he should not be in that job. If he didn't want it and he was just trying to undercut Hugh Jackson, who did and intentionally sabotaged it, again, he should not be in that job. Either way, that guy ought to be in a Washington law courtroom someplace now and get him the hell out of the Browns organization. Yeah. Which one is it?
Having said what I said earlier about, you know, it's possible.
You said it could be.
I don't think it's likely. Okay, that it was sabotage. What I think happened is this: Jackson got antsy as the trade deadline neared. When he realized that Garoppolo was not in play, and obviously Belichick says he didn't want to deal with the Browns, so you can't, you know, I initially wanted to put that one on the Browns for missing the opportunity, but if Belichick doesn't want to deal with you, then that, you know, that there's nothing you could do. But the bottom line is Jackson, in my opinion, my guess, reading the tea leaves, finds out that, okay, Garoppolo, we didn't get him. I need victories in the worst way. The trade deadline is approaching. And A.J. McCarron might be available. So, Jackson, in my opinion, does his own, you know, Bengals connections work, and he cooks up a trade scenario where they could possibly land McCarron. He does it unbeknownst to the front office. When he brings the front office into it at the last hour, literally, the front office is like, what? Are you sure? Wait. A.J. McCarron for these picks? What? And so they're scrambling. I'm guessing, again, just a total guess, no sourcing on this, but just those two have a conversation or email or texting, whatever, where they go back and forth, where the front office tries to talk Jackson out of it. Jackson's like, no, I want McCarron, and this is the deal that I've got, you know, cooked up. And so when they finally get around to acquiescing, the front office does, to Jackson's wishes, it gets up to the point where it's, you know, 358 or whatever it is, and they just wind up not being able to seal the deal with the correct documentation or whatnot. So I don't think it's incompetence as much as it is last-second scrambling, worn out.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to stop you there, Dennis, and say what you just described was Neolithic incompetence. It really was. It was just incompetence. If Sashi Brown, the decision maker, the executive vice president in charge of the roster, didn't want McCarron for those deals, he tells his head coach confidently, "No, we're not making that deal. It's too much." It doesn't come to, I really don't want to do this. Can I talk you out of this? And, you know, and then, well, okay. And now at the end of the day, we didn't get it in time. That is flat-out incompetence. If he doesn't have the guts and the courage to stand in a room with Hugh Jackson and say, it's not going to happen, we're not making that trade, those are too valuable of assets to take for him, who is not Jimmy Garoppolo. Coach, no, we're not doing this. If he is too afraid and unwilling to say that, then he is incompetent for the job, as I said at the start of this segment. So that's all I can say.
You and I use different words. I think that instead of, you know, in substituting, I would substitute disconnect for incompetence, because what it says to me is that the front office just isn't on the same page as Hugh Jackson. And vice versa.
And whose job is that? In any business hierarchy, Dennis, if there is that kind of a disconnect, doesn't that fall to the superior? Isn't it his job to make sure his subordinates are on the same page and that they are laying down the law. This is how it's run in this department. Yeah. You report to me. I will tell you what yay or nay on decisions. That's the way a business is run, and this is a business. He is the executive. He gets final say. If he wanted to say no, he should have said no, but he was afraid to say no because he isn't right for the job. He has never been in a job anything closely related to being a front office executive, and the fact that Jimmy Haslam put in there, if this were court, would be called malpractice. Malpractice with the ownership of his business.
And I'll tell you what, I can also play this in my mind, Bob. I can play the conversation, whether it happened over the phone or, again, text message, emails, whatever, where Hugh Jackson says, hey, I don't care if you don't like it. You're not the one who's 1-23, okay? I'm the guy who's 1-23, including 0-8 in 2017. My butt is on the line more than yours is because of the bottom line, which is the win-loss record. So I want McCarron.
And that's fine. He can say that. That's his take. That's his say. And that's what happens in business. You might have a department manager who says this, but the EVP over that runs that and other departments can say, no, denied. Any department head can request a certain budget for a given year in a given corporation. And guess what? Somebody else has to make the decision on what that budget. Nope, you're going to get, 79% of what your requested budget was. Make do with that. That's what executives do, and that's the point. Sashi Brown is no executive. He has no business being in that position. It is unconscionable. I just read you his resume, at least from Wikipedia. I read it to you. Where in that resume does it say qualified to be in charge of the roster and the coaching staff for a National Football League team? Give me a break. That's why I hope they blow the whole goddang building up. Blow it up. Nobody in it, of course. I don't want any fatalities, but blow it up. And then proverbially, blow up the entire organization and replace them with them. I mean, I swear to God, new colors and everything, Dennis. I'm just done with these pathetic pieces of trash.
All right. Are you now feeling better that you released that?
This has been building for weeks, D-Man. This has been building for weeks. I want the full 0-16 Magilla. It'll be worse with 0-16 following a 1-15, which would be a 1-31 by my count, is worse than the 0-26 at the expansion start of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers organization. 1-31 will be the worst stretch of football in the history of the National Football League, and I want them to own every bit of it, and I want Jimmy and D. Haslam, the pieces of crap that they are, to feel every inch of that pain. That's what I want.
Well, let me say this, Bob. Let me say this now about 0-8, okay? You have gotten into the territory, and I even said this to you last year when we were talking about how bad the Browns were. You got into the territory now where the opponent circles the Browns, all right? They circle that game because no way we're losing to these guys.
That's a win.
All right, we're not going to be the team that loses to these guys. So whereas you might say, well, a team will overlook a hapless bunch. Not anymore. Now when you get this deep into a season and you haven't won a game, I think you get the opponent's best shot. And last year they were lucky enough to avoid an 0-16 when the Chargers had a disaster at First Energy Stadium. This year, when I look at the remaining teams, I only see one chance, realistic chance for a victory, and it's the Green Bay Packers. Now that Aaron Rodgers is out of there. You watched last night, you see the Packers and the way they play against the Lions. By the way, the Lions' next opponent for the Browns, if you think for 1 second the Lions are going to overlook the Browns, as I said, they won't. Okay, but you have the Lions, you have the Chargers looking for payback at home against the Browns. You have the three division teams again. Those are losses. You've got the Bears. I think the Bears win it. And then you have the Packers and Lions. So I think the only realistic chance for the Browns the remainder of the way is the Green Bay Packers at home.
I think you may be right, and I think even that is begging, because I don't think so. Brett Hundley didn't look that bad. He didn't look like Aaron Rodgers last night, by the way, but he didn't look that bad. He had an 86 quarterback rating. He didn't throw any touchdowns, but he didn't throw any picks. He did throw for, 260-some-odd yards. No. It's not a good team without Aaron Rodgers, but I still think they beat the Browns. I'm pushing for 0-16, and I'm going to stick to it. D-Man, we filled the entire damn segment without talking about the wreck Cavaliers. Yesterday, as you know, just real quick, yesterday, you know, Ty Lue is talking about how embarrassed they should be. This is unacceptable. Most of the guys on the team are talking about how the effort isn't there. Dwayne Wade, who is not a starter, is saying that we need to start games better, which is taking shots at the starting teammates that he has. And by the way, when he does come on, he is a shell of his former self. He is offering nothing. The D. Rose experiment isn't working. Isaiah Thomas is still playing, 94-year-old geriatric bad hip guy. LeBron is still being LeBron when he wants to against good teams, and he is coasting against bad teams. They're getting blown out by an average of 15 points a game against teams that are non-playoff teams from a year ago. For crying out loud, what the hell is going on out there, D-Man? Just real quick, in about a minute.
Yeah, let me say this. First of all, Ty Lue misspoke, because when he says the Browns and the Cavs are embarrassed, pro athletes these days don't get embarrassed. I've learned that. They make too much money to get embarrassed. They laugh at us. We don't laugh at them. Bottom line is the Cavs right now look old and slow. I don't know that the old and slow stuff disappears. No matter what effort you're talking about, because you can only have so much, you know, you don't have the youth and you don't have the quicks. That's not going to be overcome by, you know, gritty gutty effort all the time. It can certainly help. You also don't have length. You know, the Cavs don't have length, so they don't defend, and that is their biggest problem. They just can't defend or don't defend. So, it'll be interesting to monitor this team going forward. But right now, as you say, the grand experiment, the veteran-laden group, is not getting it done. But I do think, in fairness to the Cavs, you have to wait to see what happens when Isaiah Thomas is integrated.
Meanwhile, Kyrie Irving is 9-2.
Couldn't go better for Kyrie than nine straight wins. And, oh, by the way, it's great to be with a competent organization. I mean, I don't know how many more blasts Kyrie can
unload. But you know what? He's earning them. He's earning them, because not only are they 9-2 and nine straight wins without Gordon Hayward, they are also, he is a superstar in all of them. He is carrying the load exactly like he wanted.
Maybe
to
the earth is flat, Bob.
Maybe it is.
Maybe Kyrie's been right all along.
Dennis Mantloff from the Plain Dealer out there in Cleveland and Cleveland.com. Dennis, thanks for the analysis. I appreciate it.
You got it, bud.
You got it. And let me just say this on the way into the second hour of the show. Hey, Cleveland Browns.
Go to hell!
See you later.
Matthews got it, wants to throw. Looks right, throws out there, wants Marvin Jones. End zone. Did he catch it? You bet. Touchdown, Detroit Lions. Oh, Marvin locked up with Devon House down the right sideline. Stafford dropped it in the basket. Marvin hauled it in, 25 yards, and a touchdown.
Who needs the red zone, right?
They got nine men in there. Stafford turns, toss, sweep, Abdullah trying to get the edge. At the five, cuts it up to the end zone. Touchdown, Detroit Lions. Matthew wants to throw again.
Here they come.
Set up the screen. Got it to Riddick. He's got room to run. Riddick, 35, 40. Riddick in midfield. Riddick into Packer territory, 40. Cuts right at the 30. Riddick at the 20. And Riddick finally taken down inside the 15-yard line. They set up the screen, and it blew up. They are deep in Packer territory after a 63-yard run after the catch by Theo Riddick. Lions on 2nd and 9 from the Packer 11. Stafford out of the gun. He's got it. Wants to throw. Looking right. Throws. End zone. It is... Did he get it? He did! Touchdown, Detroit Lions! Marvin Jones, oh, what a catch! Two teams will meet out in the middle of the field to say, job well done, job better done on this night by the Detroit Lions, and man, did they need it.
This was an important game for us. It was very important because it's the next game, and it was a division game. It was good to get one at this time. Certainly played well. The guys caught the ball well for him all across the board. Marvin with over 100 yards, Golden with over 100. Ebron had some nice catches. Obviously, Theo does what Theo does. When he catches it, makes some things happen. So when he does have time, he can deliver it.
You know, every game is huge, you know, especially a division game on the road in a tough place to play like Lambeau. It was a game we were, excited about, a Monday nighter. You know, I'm just glad we came out and performed. It was a total team win. Our defense played great. Our special teams was great as well. You know, we keep putting performances like that, you know, together, we'll give ourselves a good chance to win. You know, we just got to continue to get better. We weren't perfect. We left some points out there, got down in the red zone, stalled out a couple times again. It was an efficient night.
I'm not for any of that shenanigan stuff. We're not going to have that. I think Josh knows that. I think if Josh is back here, he's going to conform and do the things that we need him to do to be a contributing member of this football team. Right now, he's on our team. He's a guy that has an opportunity to move forward in his life. Do we want to have all the other things that come with it? I think hopefully that's behind him. We don't. Let's just be honest. We don't want those things. But as we move forward, if he can do the things that we do as football team members and conduct himself the right way and handle those things, Josh Gordon is welcome back here.
This is just a matter of getting to a deal too late in the process. Both Cincinnati and us tried our damnedest to try to get the paperwork in at the last minute. And we're talking about minutes and seconds before the trade deadline ended. We were on the phone with the NFL at the time to try to make it happen. It did not happen. I do think Cincinnati and Ernest tried it. I know we did everything humanly possible to get it done. It just didn't happen. It is truly that simple. There's no paperwork that either side got in that would allow a deal to happen, and it's truly that simple. They had our paperwork, we had theirs, and then it was incumbent upon us to send it.
They're going to have to make some starting lineup changes, I believe, and that's a little bit of an issue within the team right now. Because had Dwayne Wade come in, get a starting job when not everybody on the team thought he should have got one. Then he took a step back out of that starting job, and now yesterday, and he's criticizing the starters after the game, saying, I'm kind of tired as a second unit having to come in here and always, you know, come back from a 15-point lead, which, by the way, he's right. The Cavs are the worst team in the NBA in the first quarter, and that's the starters.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. 14 minutes after the hour, 4 o'clock, as we roll onward. It's hour number 2. Don't forget, we'll take you until 5 o'clock when it will be drive time with Mr. Miller coming your way right here on The Ticket. A lot of stuff to get into. Jim, at the start of the show, we started talking about the Lions' win last night. And made a big deal. And I'll open up the phone lines, by the way. If you've got something to say about this, it's 866-240-1065. Or you can also hit us up on Twitter at our Twitter handle, which is SportsRadio1065, or Facebook, which is 1065 The Ticket. Kush, we talked about the quarterback battle last night and how Brett Hundley did not play badly.
Right.
He really did not play poorly. He didn't go wet the bed with a quarterback rating of 33 or something in the face of this this monstrous Detroit defense. He played pretty well, actually. He had a quarterback rating of 86, threw for 245 yards, 26 out of 38, pretty healthy completion percentage, and didn't get any touchdowns in the end zone. No touchdown passes, but no interceptions either. All things considered, with a very weak roster, I think, surrounding him, he played about as well as a backup who is not Aaron Rodgers could have played. And Matthew Stafford simply dominated him in terms of the quarterback battle. 26 of 33 for 361, two touchdowns, no interceptions, a QBR of 93.4, which is stellar on a scale of 100, and a quarterback rating of 132.4, which is on a rating of scale of, I think, 156.8. I think it's like 156.8 is how that quarterback rating is calculated. So a monster night for Matthew Stafford. And you heard Jim Caldwell talking a little bit about how Golden Tate and Marvin Jones even went over 100 yards. Theo Riddick did some good things, too, averaging about 15 yards a catch on his four catches and on down the line. But it's about the quarterbacks. And it's if you look at, and I'm just looking at the schedule here, because we called last night a must win, or at least a you simply cannot afford to lose.
Right.
It would have been their fifth loss in their last six games, and it just would have sent
and four in a row, yep.
A tailspin. Yeah, four in a row, right. And I think it would have just, you know, led to a tailspin, even though the schedule is what I'm about to discuss. But now that you approach this schedule and Matthew Stafford having a Stafford-type game, and he had not had many of those in the first half after cashing in on the richest contract in league history. Now that you saw Stafford being Stafford, and if we do what we did for this game, comparing Stafford to Hundley, to the other games to come, look at what we're faced with here, Kush. If you're a Lions fan, you have to be feeling very, very good about this. And quite frankly, you kind of have to be believing that the Packers not only can, but should win their division. Even though they trail the Vikings at this particular point in time by two games, it's one if they came down to a tie because they already beat Minnesota. They have them again coming up in 3 weeks. But they have an opportunity to do some things. I want you to look at the quarterback matchups for the rest of this season for the Lions, since this is a quarterback-driven league. We agree on that?
Yes.
It's a quarterback-driven league by and large. Usually, not always, usually the team with the best quarterback wins.
Right.
In this league. So here's the rundown. This coming Sunday, November 12th, it's Matthew Stafford against rookie DeShone Kizer. Following week, it's Matthew Stafford against rookie Mitch Trubisky. Following week, it's Matthew Stafford against Case Keenum. Following week, it's Matthew Stafford, perhaps the biggest challenge of them thus far, Joe Flacco and the Ravens, who are not exactly setting the world on fire this season either.
Right.
Then it's Matthew Stafford against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, Jameis Winston. If Jameis Winston is back, he's supposed to be out for at least 2 weeks, and he is having a horrible season, not to mention a complete loss of control of his football team and his own emotions. You saw what happened. He started picking a fight with Marshawn Lattimore on Sunday by poking him in the back of the helmet for no reason whatsoever, just jawing and trash talking.
Yeah, for those who hadn't heard, this couple weeks thing, no, not an injury. He's being benched for a couple weeks because of all these things.
That's right, because of his own situation. That's why I said assuming he's back.
Right.
Because we don't know. We don't know what they're going to do. Because not only did he precipitate the pushback by Lattimore against him, that led to Mike Evans, their best offensive player, arguably, getting suspended for this week's game.
That's right.
Because he came to Winston's defense, if you want to call it that, by attacking with a blindside shot on Lattimore. But anyway, it's Matthew Stafford against Winston, and I don't know who's going to start for them this week, who their backup is. That's irrelevant. It's a big advantage. Then it's Matthew Stafford once again against rookie Mitch Trubisky. Then it's Matthew Stafford against struggling and maybe done in Cincinnati Andy Dalton. And then it's right back to it against an Aaron Rodgers less probably Brett Hundley quarterback Green Bay team again. Jim, if you look at the second half schedule in those eight games, quite simply, I think the Lions should be favored in at least seven of them. I might give Baltimore on the road the favorite status there, and I'm not a Vegas bookmaker, obviously. But Baltimore, I think, would probably have just the home field advantage there, which might lead to it.
Sure.
But they should be favored on the road at Chicago. They should be favored at home against Minnesota.
I can agree with that.
They should be favored on the road at Tampa based on what the Tampa is. Not maybe the Tampa we saw on paper at the start of the season, but they are now. They should be favored at home against Chicago, on the road at Cincinnati, and on at home against Green Bay. And I'm not expecting them to go 8-0 and finish this season 12-4, but there is no reason they cannot and should not win the AFC or the NFC North when you consider just in a quarterback's league the quarterback matchups.
Yeah, absolutely. And, forget the favored status for a minute. I'm looking over this schedule, not even thinking about just the quarterback, but the teams in general. And if you want to rank these from a Lions perspective as toughest opponents, the toughest opponent left is Thanksgiving against Minnesota, and that's going to be a crucial game, especially if the Lions can win the next two.
And it's at home.
And it's at home because it's Thanksgiving, of course. But if they can win the next two, then they keep pace with the Vikings, who are two games better at this moment than anybody else in that division. Then I'd go a toss-up between home to Green Bay on last day of the season and at Baltimore only because of the quarterback situation. That Correct. Home to Green Bay would be the toughest if Aaron Rodgers is there, but I don't think he will be, exactly.
And the reason why is because I expect them to continue to struggle behind Hundley.
Yeah.
Not that that's Hundley's fault.
Right.
But they don't have a very good team. Aaron Rodgers cured a lot of their ills.
Darn
he put
right.
a lot of Band-Aids on a lot of wounds that Green
That's
Bay
what
has.
An elite, and you hear that, Cleveland? That's what an elite quarterback can
That's
do.
Right. But my point to that is because I think they're going to struggle mightily, they will not be in the playoff hunt. And why bring Aaron Rodgers back for the last game or two of the season if his collarbone is healed up?
Sure.
And risk it for a non-playoff push? I cannot imagine that in a million years.
Yeah, if
they were still in it, maybe, and he was cleared, maybe he comes back and plays.
Agreed.
But they won't be, and so you will not see him. Last game will also be Hundley or someone else.
I completely agree with that. If the Packers are out of the playoffs by the end of this season, the last, let's call it 2 weeks or so, and they think Aaron Rodgers can come back, yeah, if I'm Packers, there's no way in heck I let him come back if the Packers are not still in it. So the point is, this is another reason to me why yesterday was such a cannot lose. And I'm, you know, you're getting me to like that term for yesterday's game a lot better than must win, even though we're really just arguing semantics, because now the schedule is so favorable that if you're able to beat the Vikings on Thanksgiving Day, which incidentally would sweep the season series, therefore tiebreaker, the Lions are in prime position to take the division, which would mean home playoff game for the first time since the Silverdome days.
Kush, I got to change the subject here for just a second.
All right.
I apologize if people have already heard this. I just did, and I stepped away from the microphone and the speakers for a few minutes while at the top of the hour. So if you had it in your update, then I apologize that I didn't catch it there. But I just became aware of this. Former Major League pitcher and Cy Young Award winner, one of the greats of his time, Roy Halladay is dead.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm finding this. Oh, good Lord.
Roy Halladay has been killed in a plane crash in the Gulf of Mexico, according to multiple reports out of Philadelphia and elsewhere. Apparently the plane was registered to his father. It looks like they were avid flyers. I'm just looking. This is all coming kind of.
Yeah, the one I'm seeing is posted from ESPN.com that I just found. That's 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, this is all coming very rapidly, and I'm just looking at a multitude of different reports, one of which shows a picture of Roy Halladay in a tweet that he sent from his official account on Halloween last week, last Tuesday. A week ago today. One Tuesday, Halloween?
Yes. Yeah, last Tuesday. It's been a week since Halloween. That was 1 week ago, yes.
It's a picture of some fighter jets, and it says, "I keep telling my dad, flying the Icon A5 low over the water is like flying a fighter jet." His response, "I am flying a fighter jet." There's another one from November 4th, so just 3 days ago. "A little flying with Pilot Roy," and I'm assuming that's his father, as they fly together. Just a horrific, horrific story. Former 8-time All-Star pitcher for the Blue Jays, won the Cy Young Award in 2003 and again in 2010. So he was 8-time All-Star with the Blue Jays and Phillies.
He's the other guy, the other one being Don Larson, that's thrown a no-hitter in postseason play. Larson's was a perfect game. Halliday's was not, but they're the only two to pull that off.
Wow. Just a tragic, tragic piece of news. I wish I hadn't seen this, but I did. It just came across my sports feed, and I wanted to share that story. We'll give you updates on it as we get them. But, yeah, this is being confirmed, as I say, by multiple. Well, this is not some Internet hoax. This is a very, very tragic moment and just a very, very sad thing. You know what's interesting? I read another sports I saw another sports alert come across my screen, Jim, about half an hour ago that said plane registered to Roy Halladay involved in deadly crash, but that's all it said.
Right.
Had
okay.
No earthly idea that he was aboard. You know, the plane registered to could mean any number of
sure.
things. You know, does he rent this out? Is it, you know, a friend, a family member? And it turns out it was indeed Roy Halladay. He was on board. So no details on how it went down or why it went down or if it was, I guess it was into the, yeah, it did. It says crashes in the Gulf of Mexico, so it went down into the water. And that's all we can say for now. So just prayers of, and obviously condolences to the Halladay family and to the Major League Baseball family. It's just a tragedy.
Yes, 40
years
is.
Old, by the way, Jim. 40 years old.
And he only retired, 2 years ago? It wasn't really that long ago.
2013,
yeah.
4 years. Yeah, yeah. Which it kind of came suddenly. You know, it's weird. You know, people talk about that cliff all the time.
Yeah.
No pun intended here.
I know where you're going with
this. Please understand when I say you talk about people going over the cliff. We talk about that a lot with Tom Brady. Is Tom Brady, you know, he's 40. At some point, you know,
I know what you're trying to say.
It happened to Peyton Manning. You know, one day he's throwing 55 touchdowns and setting a new NFL single season record, and the next day he can't throw anymore. It's like you just, you know, the proverbial cliff. You went over the cliff. It just ends for you. It's just like the body catches up to you and you can't do what you used to do. When will that happen to Tom Brady? That kind of happened to Roy Halladay's career, I think, a little bit, because he was just kind of cruising along, going great guns, and when he wasn't able to get guys out anymore, it just seemed like it happened like bing, bang, boom, very, very quickly. It just seemed like very, very quickly he went from being a very good, you know, quality starter, if not the, you know, the Cy Young Award type pitcher that he was in 2010, but to just not being able to get anybody out. And that's kind of how it happened with him. Let me see if I have this exactly. Yeah, he retired. Well, he stopped pitching, essentially, it looks like, in August of 2013 in a rehab start.
That's longer ago than I thought.
Or after a rehab, yeah. He struggled in spring training in his last year in 2013, gave up 5 runs in his first start. After struggling in his subsequent starts, Halliday pitched 8 innings, allowing just 1 run on April 14th, however. He recorded his 200th career win in that game. May 5th, gave up 9 runs in just 2 1/3. The next day, he's on the DL with a right shoulder. This was his cliff that we talk about, that proverbial cliff.
Mm-hmm.
Right shoulder injury, announced he would have surgery on it, have a bone spur removed. Surgery addressed the fraying of his labrum and rotator cuff. Initially supposed to make a rehab start for AA Reading that day. An 18-inning game the previous night caused the Phillies to have a shortage of pitchers and such, and as such, he returned to the major leagues instead of the AA start on August 25th for a start against the Diamondbacks, in which he threw 6 innings, allowing 2 runs and 4 hits with two walks and 2 strikeouts. These are apparently just some highlights of his year. But then he announced signing a one-day ceremonial contract with the Blue Jays and announced his retirement on December 9th due to that injury. So he went from, again, being just tremendous to an injury essentially cutting it off and cutting off his ability, and it was over. So anyway, he has passed away now, just an absolutely terrible, terrible news, some terrible news to share. Tell you what we're going to do. Going to step away and get a bottom-of-the-hour sports center, local sports center coming your way. Process that a little bit before we get into some other things. If you are a Lions fan, I would very much like to hear from you about that. What I said is we kind of ran down the matchups here. Jim, I'm not predicting 8-0. I'm not even going to predict 7-1, and I don't think it needs to be. But I think it absolutely should be 6-2 at its worst. I think 6-2 down the stretch, which would give them a 10-6 record and should win them the division, based on what I think Minnesota will do. When you have Stafford versus Kaiser, Trubisky, Keenum, then Flacco, that might be one of your two, then Winston or backup, then Trubisky again, then Dalton, and then Brett Hundley again like yesterday. To me, that's a 6-2 second half for the Lions. And it ought to have them in the thick of the whole thing by winning the NFC North. If they do less than that, I think it's a major, major embarrassment to A, Matthew Stafford, and B, to Coach Caldwell, because that schedule just lends itself to a Detroit division title. That's what I see. Tell me if you agree or disagree. 866-240-1065 right here on The Ticket.
Be part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 1065 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. Rolling on are we. 24 minutes of outstanding awesome left for you before drive time comes your way at 5 o'clock. A reminder for you, some sports news you can use. When you watch your sports, that is, at Buffalo Wild Wings, you can earn loyalty points now at B-Dubs with Blazin' Rewards. And if you hurry, you can earn these points by eating limited-time items like the Cali Chicken Sandwich, the Fiesta Pork Tacos. That sounds really good. The Specialty 35th Weck Sandwich and more. Plus, like a quarterback's favorite receiver, B-Dubs has the perfect wing sauce pairing for the Blue Moon Belgian White Beer. It's called Blue Moon Barbecue. Get that on your wings. You're going to love it. It's available for a limited time while supplies last. And only at Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports. Please drink responsibly. Kush, how about the NBA news of the day today? And not the news that the Cavaliers don't care and that they're playing like crap and nobody seems to mind. And actually, you know what? Well, we'll come back to that. We'll come back to the contradictions there. Because, you know, we hear LeBron talk about how these games don't matter because this is October and now it's November.
Right.
And this doesn't mean much. And if it doesn't mean much, then why are Ty Lue and other Cavaliers complaining about how much these games mean and how embarrassed they are to be playing this way? Which is it? There seems to be a disconnect. On a team with a whole bunch of new faces playing together for the first time, or in Wade and LeBron's case, the second time. But a whole bunch of new players playing together for the first time. Gee, whoever called that there would be a massive disconnect? But there is. LeBron says these games don't matter. Ty Lu and others say they do, and that they're embarrassed for losing them the way they are. I side with the latter, not with the former, and I'll explain that in a moment. But let's talk about the big NBA news of the day, and you talked about it too, Jim, in your reports. How about Eric Bledsoe,
yeah,
who found his way to get out of Phoenix by simply tweeting about a week and a half ago, I don't want to be here.
I knew it would take about 2 weeks before he'd be on another team.
That's right. I don't want to be here. And, of course, because of the embarrassment of that, it's just so blatantly obvious that he is, you know, trying to disparage the team and the city in which he plays. He says, no, for those who forgot the story. I was at a beauty parlor with my girl, and I really didn't want to be there. It was annoying, so I just tweeted, don't want to be here. Yeah.
Give him a few points for originality for that one.
I give him credit. I do. I really do. You know, because I don't want to say who among us, because I'm sure there are lots among us who haven't tweeted something in regret. But when you're famous to the level of Eric Bledsoe famous, NBA All-Star famous, you really have to read every last word before you push send. Don't push send or tweet or whatever. Don't do it without being very, very, very sure this is what you want people to see. Having said that, who among us hasn't occasionally, I probably shouldn't have said that, and quickly tried to delete it, hoping nobody grabbed it, did the old screen grab or screenshot. And so I think he probably, that's going to look really bad. I couldn't pull it back in, so I have to think of something else. And he tried it, but they weren't buying it. He knew he asked for a trade in the offseason. They couldn't find a way to get a trade done in the offseason. So for him to say that now, especially as the Suns started their season with three embarrassing losses in a row, and we're talking 30, 40-point, you know, historic blowout losses and a change in coaches very, very quickly. Front office knew full well he meant he wanted out, and they said, he's done playing with us. We're not going to do this. Kush, I got to tell you, from a front office standpoint, home run. I mean, knowing that you are not negotiating from a position of strength, to get Greg Monroe and two picks, a first and a second, yes, they're protected, but still, to get a first and a second and Greg Monroe for Eric Bledsoe, knowing that you had to trade him because you announced publicly that we're going to part ways, he's done with us, we're not going to put him in uniform again, anybody that's going to trade for him isn't exactly going to be willing to give up the mother load.
Uh-huh.
Even for a guy coming off his career high in points and assists like Eric Bledsoe.
Sure.
So, nice job.
Yeah.
Nice job, I think, by the Phoenix front office for getting this deal done, which is a 2018 first and second round pick from the Milwaukee Bucks and Greg Monroe.
The former Piston.
A former Piston, that's right. I mean, that's not bad at all considering the circumstances. And what it does, it really, really, I think, affects the Eastern Conference in a very good way from a competitive standpoint. We all know that the Bucks are a playoff team. We all know that the Greek Freak is on the verge of, I don't know, maybe even ascending higher than his current level as a, you know, budding NBA superstar, and maybe getting ready to surpass some of the other young superstar names as the guy in this league in very, very short order. I mean, Giannis Antetokounmpo is just a monster. He's getting better with every single game. He's getting better every week. He's getting better every season. He's averaging 31 points a game and 9.9 rebounds and 5 assists, and he's shooting nearly 60 freaking percent. And he doesn't do that from inside all the time, and with his ridiculous, ferocious dunks, he can shoot the basketball. He's tremendous. And now he just got a running mate. Now he just got himself a partner.
Yep.
Now you just got, and we'll see. We'll see how long it takes for them to mesh. We'll see how long it takes for them to work together. But potentially, he may have just gotten the best, or you may have just seen assembled the best 1-2 scoring and game breaking or playmaking duos in the Eastern Conference. And I say that because you don't have LeBron James and Isaiah Thomas yet. I say that because you don't have LeBron James and Kyrie Irving anymore. I say that because Kyrie Irving doesn't have Gordon Hayward. I say that because, and help take me through the rest of the Eastern Conference here, Kush. I'm trying to think of 1-2 punches that are, you know, among elite teams. You could certainly say the way the season has started, there's some good things happening with the Pistons, among others. But, you know, when you're talking about elite all-star caliber players, I don't know that there were two other all-stars in the East now. Lowry and DeRozan still? Is that?
Do you want to go Wall and Beal at all?
Wall and Beal, okay, okay. We got a conversation there, but...
Lowry, DeRozan still?
I said Lowry, DeRozan.
Oh, you did, okay.
Ago, but yeah, and maybe, okay, there's some names. But the point is, it's in the conversation. When Bledsoe gets going, when Bledsoe, you know, kind of fits in and figures out, and of course he's got some damage control to do in terms of his reputation. There's going to be a very bright spotlight on him. People are going to be, you know, really kind of getting on his case if he doesn't perform in you know, spectacular ways. Let me see his career averages at this particular point, if I can find them. Yeah, he averaged a career high. 21.1 points per game last year, a career high. Trying to find the assist total here, if I can get that real quick. A career high 6.3 assists a year ago as well. Bonafide superstar. Bonafide all-star. Let's do that. Superstar, I kind of reserve for the LeBrons and Kevin Durant and Steph Curry's.
There is a different level between all-star and superstar. All-star. Bledsoe's in all-star category.
Legit all-star. If you're a 20, and that would be a second straight year of 20-point scoring, by the way. And his second straight year of third straight year of 6-plus assists. He's a flat-out star. Make no mistake about it. When you put the Greek freak and Eric Bledsoe together, once he becomes what he was in Phoenix, what do you think in the Eastern Conference? Beal and Wall. Wall would be the brighter of the two stars, the way the freak would. DeRozan probably just a shade over Lowry. LeBron, I cannot do because... You know, it's not Derrick Rose anymore. It's not Dwayne Wade. He's not what he was anymore. It's Kevin Love isn't at that level. And Isaiah Thomas could be when he's there, but he's not. I think the Eastern Conference may have just been shaken up. The Eastern Conference may have just endured a shakeup that is going to be felt for a while with Eric Bledsoe coming over from Phoenix to the Eastern Conference. To join the Bucks.
Well,
we'll
see exactly how long in a while. I remember when this first came up, and there was should the Cavs be talking to him? We did find out that he's got a 1 year left at $15 million for next year, so he's a Milwaukee Buck through next season. We'll see what happens after that. I mean, no offense to Milwaukee, but unless the Greek Freak is really taking them to 55 wins and 1-2 seeds, free agents still really aren't coming to Milwaukee. But yeah, it definitely shakes it up a little bit because
I don't know, Jim. Do me a favor.
Okay.
Compare the attractiveness of playing in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, to Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. I don't think there's much difference between the two.
We were talking about this after Kevin Durant leaving and all that stuff.
But I'm talking about it now because Durant left. But my point of this is Russell Westbrook's presence there created what you have there now, which is stars saying it's Oklahoma City, it's in the Midwest, it's in a small town, relatively speaking, it's not New York or L.A., you know, it's not even Miami, it's Oklahoma City, but you know what, look who sits there, Russell Westbrook, the dynamic MVP Russell Westbrook, Paul George, make that
that in recent history of the Thunder Anthony. Is keeping that alive. Call me back on that one in about 8 to 10 years. We'll see what players think about going to OKC.
No, but I think you're missing my point. My point is, despite OKC being all of those things, they're there because they want to play with a superstar like Russell Westbrook. Milwaukee being in the same kind of boat as OKC from a, you know, an attractiveness geographical standpoint or lack thereof. I'm not trying to insult anybody's city.
Sure.
But just comparatively, the Greek Freak is a Westbrook type of star. I can see them trying, and just like Cleveland. Look, you know, Cleveland, Ohio is one of those major markets. And yes, they had the advantage of LeBron being from Akron when he, you know, was drafted there and then, of course, came back the second time around and that brought Kevin Love. And, you know, it brought other star or you know, starting type players wanting to come. If the star is right, even the Midwestern, not traditionally attractive to free agent cities become a little more attractive. If you can play with Westbrook, if you can play with Antetokounmpo, those kinds of things can happen.
No, and they can. And by the way, on that type of front, because it's, you're right, it's less of about a city and a location as it is superstar around
right.
you. That's why OKC isn't in that, why would I want to go to Oklahoma City? You know, wait 8
right.
to 10 years when Russell Westbrook's not there. On that note, however, on that note at the same time, it should be, this will be the point where I point out that the Greek Freak is signed through 2020-2021 with Milwaukee.
So it's 4 years.
So it's, counting this year, it's 4 more years.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That makes it an attractive thing, because think about this. When you're a star caliber player and you want to have as much exposure to expand your brand as possible, that means getting on TNT as much as possible. You know, the Lakers are going to be on TNT because it's the Lakers.
Even when they
because
stink,
of
course.
Even when they stink. The Cavaliers, the Warriors.
LeBron
they're
leaves,
be on TNT.
The Cavs will be lucky to get 5 total national TV games all season.
Who will?
The Cavs.
Well,
LeBron's no longer there. The
correct.
Cavs will be lucky to get 5 total
correct.
On all
but
the channels.
But they're on because, they're 3-time defending conference champions and because LeBron James is the most popular player in the world.
Of course.
Oklahoma City is on TV, on national TV, a ton because of Russell Westbrook. I want to get on national TV. I better go play with that guy.
Yeah.
I promise you, Greek Freak is going to be the same way.
You're going to see
the Milwaukee Bucks, who ordinarily wouldn't get 3 or 4 national TV games a year, are going to get a dozen or more because of the presence of this outstanding, spectacular, fun-to-watch superstar. And who wouldn't want to come and be a part of that? So I can see Bledsoe wanting to sign long-term to play with the Freak, and I could see them maybe pulling in another free agent to really create a team that could supplant the Cavaliers as the Eastern Conference's premier team.
Bingo, that's the last part right there. That last part right there is the extra key. It's the icing on top. Even though at this moment, coming into, by the way, a Bucks-Cavs game tonight, the Bucks are only slightly better at the moment than the Cavs, 4-5. But future, especially beyond this year when everybody in theory knows, quote unquote, that LeBron is leaving Cleveland, then you have a new dynamic at the top of the East. And this is a great way for Milwaukee to say, hey, it's us and it's Boston. Oh, how's that for retro circa 1984, by the way?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that's phenomenal.
Didn't the Bucks and Celtics meet like 3 times in the East Finals right there in the mid-80s? Boston, of course, won all of them, but I want to say it was 2 or 3. It's forgotten by a lot of people, but they were a halfway decent team through the 80s.
They were terrific, and I remember one of my favorite players, one of the most outstanding aerial acrobats during that time was Marcus Johnson of the Bucks. Marcus Johnson was a superstar and one of my favorite guys to watch. He had some showdowns with, like you said, with the Celtics. It was really amazing. So,
yeah,
when the Cavaliers eventually dissipate as a perennial contender and Eastern Conference champion,
seemingly very likely after this season,
if LeBron leaves,
right?
And who knows? By the way, odds makers say that he's still an odds-on favorite to re-sign with the Cavaliers, which changes the conversation we're having
completely.
The second team that, or city, according to the odds makers, that is more likely for him to sign with would be Los Angeles to go play with the Lakers. But those odds have become longer in the start of this season because the Lonzo Ball portion of that puzzle out there is a lot.
I got some news on that front, but go ahead. Keep going.
It's a questionable thing. I mean, the paper talking points going into this season were, holy cow, LeBron's talking about how he's got a home in L.A. and how much, you know, when I come home to Los Angeles, I'll come up and see you up there in Seattle, blah, 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 or Portland or whatever it was. And the thinking was, Lonzo Ball, the next Magic Johnson type of, or I think some people say Jason Kidd type of ball distributor with LeBron James, with the rising stars, Brandon Ingram,
mm-hmm.
And who else did they acquire?
Veteran big man Brock Lopez. Brooke Lopez. I don't know why I always call him Brock.
I don't know. You do that a lot.
I do.
Brooke Lopez, and boy, they could be building something special out there. But the key to all of that would be the point guard.
Yep.
Lonzo Ball, who is struggling in a mighty way in a mighty way in this early going, and it's already gotten his pops flapping his gums. Cushland. And I don't know if this is your story you were going to say.
No, I don't think it is, but
let me finish mine.
Go ahead.
Pop's ball is flapping his gums that his son Lonzo needs to play the whole fourth quarter. He's unhappy with his son's playing time, particularly in the fourth quarter, saying play him the whole fourth quarter and let him get his groove and you won't lose, is what he is saying now publicly. I said this back long before the NBA draft. If I'm the Lakers, I don't touch him. I wouldn't touch him because of what's going to happen when Pop starts going off. First of all, he has got every point guard in the league licking their chops to go at his son because of his $800 tennis shoes before he's ever played a game.
And we've seen this manifest itself at least two or three times already in the early going.
Yep. They want to school him. They want to embarrass him all because of his dad's mouth. And quite frankly, Lonzo has it coming because Lonzo has not and will not publicly tell Pops to shut up. He has said, just, hey, that's his dad being dad. I'm going to go do my thing. And people think that his quiet response to it is his agreement with it, that I am all that. You know, if you don't shut dad up, then you are essentially encouraging dad to keep going. So that's how it has gone. So between the other point guards wanting to destroy him and being successful at it in large part, and the fact that dad is going to start flapping his gums, I said it before, I would not touch him.
Yep.
I would not even consider drafting him, especially if I'm in LA where the Ball family lives, which is why the other two are supposed to be going to UCLA as well. Because when he starts talking about the Chino Hills high school coach, and he's not using my son right, and then he starts talking about the UCLA coach, Steve Alford, he's not using my son right, and you know it's going to continue to the NBA. And if I'm the NBA, I'm not trying to hear any of that nonsense, and it's just going to be a major distraction. His teammates are going to get sick of it. His opponents are already sick of it. Point being, and I'm really getting off into the tangent there of Lonzo Ball, that may not be as attractive a place for LeBron James to want to be in the middle of that circus as previously thought, especially with Lonzo not playing very well at this stage of his rookie season. What news did you have on that?
My news is, and I'm glad you threw out the part about good old LeVar shooting his mouth off, because I can't wait to hear how he's going to shoot his mouth off about this one. This is just 30 minutes ago. Jeff Goodman over at ESPN College Basketball Insider. Check this out. Three UCLA men's basketball players, including LiAngelo Ball, that's the younger brother who's now UCLA, were arrested in China just days before their Friday season opener against Georgia Tech in Shanghai. One source told ESPN the players, which included freshman Cody Riley and Jalen Hill, arrested on shoplifting charges.
Wow. So what? I guess Big Baller Brand's not doing as well as maybe they had hoped to.
Not right now.
He's not making enough money with Big Baller Brand. He's got to go out and shoplift.
Can't
and steal
wait
stuff.
To hear Pop's explanation for this one.
Oh, my goodness. And it happened in China, you said?
Yes, because UCLA is going to take on Georgia Tech coming up. Because college basketball, incidentally, starts for pretty much everybody this weekend, in case you didn't know. And apparently UCLA and Georgia Tech are going to be playing a game over there in China.
Wow.
And that's why he was arrested in Shanghai, apparently, or in China, not Shanghai, but in China.
Right, in China. Wow, that is hilarious. So, okay, well, we'll see what the mouth that roared has to say about that. But meanwhile, his son is struggling, and that may change the LeBron dynamic that we talked about. But for now, and I'm just spitballing here, there are a lot of people around the NBA who are really going to be really excited about Bledsoe to Milwaukee because they're tired of the Cavs-Warriors, you know, epic reruns every June for the last 3 years. They want to see fresh blood. They want to see the Celtics grow and become what they're going to become with Kyrie. And they're going to be very excited about the Bledsoe Greek Freak combination in the Eastern Conference. It could shake things up in a big, big way, not just this year, but for the next several years to come. And that is where we have to leave it. All right, thanks so much for being a part of the conversation today. Thanks to Dennis Mandeloff for joining us tomorrow. Chris, what do we have on the show tomorrow?
Tomorrow, as of right now.
Jason Candle, I believe.
I'm working on a couple things. Jason Candle. We're also going to talk Bill Connolly, as we'll be back on the show. The college rankings come out tonight.
Can't wait for that. So we'll analyze those rankings and see exactly how far the Buckeyes dropped after their big loss to Iowa. So that'll be a part of tomorrow's show as well. All right, that's it. That's all the time we have. Drive Time is coming up next. Stay where you are for Mike Miller right here on the team.